history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are some stories out there that need to be told, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We really need to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in a city I'm sure you've heard of, Las Vegas, Nevada, home for the last quarter century to Bob Andre, 92 years old, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran of World War II, which we're going to hear about, and some of the decorations that he earned in those 2 years in the Pacific. But let's start before that, Bob. You grow up in the East Bay in California, the Richmond-Oakland area, which before World War II, what was that like? Probably a little different from today.
Very quiet, very nice. Enjoyed very much living there because of the environment. As far as entertainment, as kids, we always had something to do. Lots of sports, school sports, lots of activity that way, mm-hmm. Basketball, baseball. But then it turned kind of sad for me at the time because I was only 15, I believe, when my mother passed away. And my stepdad was young enough. He joined the Navy instead of the Army. He didn't want to be drafted there, so that left my older brother and I on our own. We have no place to go. So I quit school and... because I had to make money to live, wow. Pay for an apartment or hotel room. So I had to earn at least $2 a night for the room. Then I traveled all around the United States on my own. And a friend of mine and I, we were just kids. And then I turned 16 and I was a Gandy dancer in Montana. That's working on the railroad, quite young, working with a jackhammer. And holding the jackhammer, I held it too tight and my hands swelled up. Then I'm heading home back to California, and I wrecked my car. Typical 15-year-old boy. And it's still in Yellowstone, I guess. Then from there, I got back to Oakland, riding the rods. And riding the rods was interesting. When I'd come to a bridge or a tunnel, they had Army stationed there, and they'd shoot at us with shotguns because we're not supposed to be doing that.
Yeah, so some of the people listening, they weren't around at this time, and they're trying to figure out, what is he talking about? So you're saying you would hop on these trains, even though you didn't have a ticket, and you're just...
Freight trains.
Yeah, not passenger trains. So where are you standing or sitting or holding on?
Well, a particular car I jumped on had flat steel for the Moore's Shipyard to build ships. And that went riding in those, which is government material, and... that's where all the Army was stationed, at the entrance of a tunnel and the exit, and the same way with bridges. And they would shoot at us. I didn't know that. First time I was waving to them until they shot at us. And I figured that they're not going to be very friendly. So we ended up, took us about 5 days to get back to California. The train was so slow, it was really loaded. Then once I got home, I went to work at the Moore's Shipyard. And I worked there for a short time, and then when I was 16, I decided I wanted to join the Marines. I saw a movie, Wake Island or something, and at 15 and 16, you're kind of get impressed. So I went to the Marine recruiter, and I said, I want to join the Marines. How old are you? I said, 17, and it didn't work too good. I had to have a guardian sign for me. I had no guardian, no mother, no father. So the recruiter said, that's no problem. All we do is take you to a judge, and he'll appoint a guardian for you for the day. Mm-hmm. And he'll sign you in the Marine Corps, which we did. I was still 16, but I didn't tell them that. We went before the judge. He signed a guardian. From there, we waltzed down to the recruiter, and he signed me in.
And you say that all matter-of-factly, but I'm sure there's some parents out there that are thinking, boy, if my teenager did all these things, riding a freight train, getting shot at by the Army, making it back here, working in the shipyard, signing up for the Marines, all as a 16-year-old. Did any of that faze you, or was that just a big adventure for you?
No, it's necessary. I had to make a living. I had to make money to eat, And as far as being shot at, I didn't think that was very nice. So I go join the Marine, and it turns out they shoot at me too. Uh-huh. That wasn't very nice either.
Yeah, I guess I need to back up too, because this might have been a memorable situation for you. And I don't know if this was before or after your stepdad left for the Navy. But December 7th, 1941, seems like everybody remembers something about Pearl Harbor Day. Do you remember where you were or how you found out what happened out there?
Yeah, we heard it on the radio. I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. I was lucky to find my school. But anyway, that was on December 7th. And this was when I signed up. It was in April of 43.
So you weren't old enough yet, Pearl Harbor Day, a couple years later. You still weren't old enough, but you convinced him you were. You get into the Marine Corps. Did you have any idea what you were in for?
Not really. As you said, a little adventure, but I got room and board. That's really what I was looking at. I had to have some place to eat, some place to sleep, and they provided all of that. They also provided me a little tank to play with. And after I learned how to drive that thing, we were bored sitting around San Diego, Jack's Farm. They asked for volunteers to go into the infantry, and we were taught not to volunteer, so I volunteered, and I ended up in the infantry as a BAR man, Browning Automatic Rifle, and went overseas finally, a very short time later, and we ended up in New Zealand. Took us 31 days to get there.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
No, and I got sick immediately. Every time I turned around, I was sick. Uh-huh. 15 days sick.
Were you wondering what you got yourself into?
No. I was just waiting for what's going to happen the next day.
So you get to New Zealand, and then they're staging you guys and preparing you for an invasion, or what?
Yes. When we landed, we were reserve Marines. The first 30 went A Company. The second 30 went to B Company. The third 30 went to C Company. And there was one guy left over. And they said, well, what are we going to do with him? That was myself. And they sent him to Dog Company. So I walked over to Dog Company and told the top sergeant that I was assigned to them. He said, you been to the galley yet? I says, no. He says, go over to mess hall. You spend 30 days there and we'll figure out what to do with you. And after 30 days of wonderful galley duty, I went back and they said, well, you're in the machine gun company now. And I was the seventh one in the machine gun squad. There's eight. With that, after we trained with a machine gun, my BAR experience was forgotten. That was for riflemen. So then after our training, we went to invade Tarawa.
And what kind of machine gun was that?
30 caliber. I had the light and the heavy. The heavy is a water cool. The light is a small barrel.
And what was your job in that squad? You're actually operating, firing the weapon or no?
I was trained. We were all trained in it. But I was assigned a seventh man, so I carried two boxes of ammunition, which they used up fast.
And when you're carrying ammunition, can you defend yourself?
Well, we carried M1 rifles, first of all, then the carbine. They gave us carbines with light ears. Yes, we could defend ourselves because when we stopped, we were staggered behind a gunner, number one, number two gunner. And I was back at the end, and as they used the ammo, we just moved up, and they took it. That was on Tarawa.
Well, and I've heard it pronounced every other way.
I've been corrected a number of times.
Well, and no matter how you pronounce it, it's a battle that a lot of people don't know a whole lot about, but it's a battle that was extremely bloody for a very tiny amount of land. Had you any idea where it was or how big it was or where you were going?
Not at the time, no.
Yeah.
We had no idea until we were ready to go in. And I was lucky I didn't go in the first wave. And so they're the ones who, the brains-to-be, miscalculated the tide. And they went in. It was not shallow, low tide. It was high tide. And then they were, when they jumped off the Amtraks or whatever we had going in, they were caught right in front of the machine because the machine guns were about 8 feet of in a wall that we didn't have much land to land on, only about 8 feet. Then there was a wall, and the machine guns were right there going into it.
So if you had been in the first wave, you probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to me.
Yeah, they got the bulk of it, and the ones that were wounded end up dying during the night. All night long, they're calling for help, but nobody could get to them. And you slowly hear the help, 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 just fade away because the Japs were out on the pier, which was their toilet. And how they determined how many Japs were on the island, they took an aerial view of the toilets, figured how many used the toilets, and that's how many Japs they figured was on the island, how they calculated it. So the next morning, we over the wall, and then we were just going from coconut tree to coconut tree, or body to body, whatever was any protection, you know.
Well, and that was my question when you got there. And here you're, you're 17 years old?
Yes, yeah.
17-year-old, never been in combat before. What did you see and hear and experience when you first got on that island?
Well, the thing we were doing is trying to get there, because we were told to get there. And as far as thinking, I wasn't thinking at all. I was just doing what I was told.
What did you see?
Well, just bodies all over the place, and we would stay as low as possible to keep from getting hit.
And were they able to get you all the way to shore, or were you guys hung up on the reef too and you had to wade in?
No, we went in rubber boats. Okay. Yeah, so we were able to get in. We got a lot of bullets in the rubber boats, but they were with so many compartments that it didn't sink. Yeah.
So you're 17 years old, you're coming ashore with dead American bodies all over the place and bullets flying your way. Yeah. Were you scared?
I didn't have time to think about that. I really didn't. And plus, being 17 and young, you didn't know what the hell was going on.
Something tells me that must have been a pretty long day for you.
Well, it sure was. It started at dark, early in the morning, aboard the ship, mm-hmm. loading up, going over the cargo nets on the ship. No, it was a long day. But when you don't get hurt, you don't think much of it.
But I'm sure some stuff came pretty close to you.
Oh, yeah, all around us. Yeah, sure. They're bouncing off everything. Yeah. You know, you don't think anything of it. I didn't. I was just doing what I was told, is getting from point A to point B without getting shot.
So you spent that whole time following these machine guns and keeping the ammunition supply going?
Staying in my position, stay where I belong, yeah.
How'd you sleep that first night?
I didn't, because they put me out on a point. This a lot of people don't know about, but they called me and he said, go out about 10, 20 feet out there. Well, turns out when I went out about 10 or 20 feet, there were Japs there. I can hear them talking. and then he finally realized what they had done. They called me back. I crawled out and I crawled back. Yeah, because you can hear them jabbering over there. Yeah.
How close do you think you were to them?
Here to her.
10 feet.
Yeah, easy. Uh-huh. Easy. But I've been closer.
Well, you're teasing us now. I'm sure there's more to come in this story here.
That's another battle.
Well, we'll get to it, I'm sure, as long as you're willing. So how long were you there? And I say an island, really. This is an atoll, a few different strips of land kind of in a collection.
That was on Bito, was the name of the island itself. That's where all the fighting took place. Now, some of the Japs left to the other islands, and they're a horseshoe shape. After 78 hours or so, then we start cleaning up the bodies of our boys. Then they told us we had to load up on the Amtraks. We were going to the other islands because the ones that are left are on the other islands running away, going around. And we went from island to island, which was we waded across. They're low tide, you can wade across from island to island. But we went about, six or seven islands, and then they replaced us. They brought other outfit in to relieve us, and we went back to the ship. And from there, we went back to Hawaii.
Well, and you say that, you know, you guys had to clean up the dead American bodies. That had to be hard, especially for a 17-year-old. How do you handle something like that?
Well, 17, you really don't know much about life. So, again, I was told to, I went with a minister, preacher, a priest or something, to go around. He would take their rings and watch off and search your pockets, and then take them back to the tent at nighttime, and he'd go through them and clean out anything that shouldn't be in the wallet and stuff like that. Then at that time, we would have a stretcher or a litter or whatever, and we'd load the body on there and take it to the airstrip and let the airstrip be 7 or 8 or 10 of them, something like that. The first one was a Navajo Indian. He was behind a stump of a coconut tree, and he was shot right through the radio and right through the head. Yeah.
Did you lose any of your friends there?
Oh, yeah. Egghead Epperson, he was killed. Matter of fact, he was awarded the Medal of Honor. He was from our squad, yeah.
What had he done that they gave him that award posthumously?
Well, he was in foxhole, and Japs were throwing hand grenades at him. He pulled them underneath him. Even though their hand grenades weren't very powerful, but they did the job. They killed him.
So he sacrificed his own life to save others?
Yeah, two other guys in a hole with him.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people have referred to your actions in World War II as heroic, and we're going to hear more about what you did. But just hearing you tell me that story about Epperson, sounds like he's someone who you might have seen as a hero.
Well, absolutely. He had a head shaped like an egg, and we all nicknamed him Egghead. I was Prune Picker because I was California. And they named a ship after him, a couple of them. Had it for so many years, and they gave it to some foreign country and sold it, and they built another one, named it after him, yeah. But that was about the end of that battle. That didn't last that long.
Yeah, it was quick, but it was devastating. It was bloody. It was deadly.
Oh, yeah. You ask about sleeping. I don't know if anybody else slept. I sure as hell didn't. Whatever I got was lucky.
Well, and I hear you talk about other guys who died there. And I have to wonder if there were moments in a foxhole or behind a stump or even while you're carrying a body on a litter where you maybe wondered, am I next? How long am I going to last out here?
No, you just try to... I really did. I don't remember thinking that way. I'm sure I was afraid or scared, but as far as thinking about it, I never really thought about it. Again, I go back to my age. Just don't think about it. I didn't. I wasn't any kind of hero or anything like that. I just, nothing registered.
It's time for our first break, but there's more to come with Marine Corps veteran Bob Andre of Las Vegas, Nevada. What did he do on Saipan that earned him the Silver Star? We'll hear it in his words and in the words of the military at the time. Take a look at what Bob looked like then and what he looks like now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with World War II Marine Corps veteran Bob Andre of Las Vegas, Nevada, a recipient of the Purple Heart and the Silver Star for his actions during July 1944 in the Battle of Saipan. We're going to hear about that in a moment. We've already heard about his experience as a 17-year-old Marine at Tarawa, a bloody battle that claimed the lives of nearly 1,700 Americans and wounded more than 2,000 more in November of 1943. So, as you say, you leave there, that one square mile of hell, as it's famously been called, and go back to Hawaii. What was that like? I mean, was that a relief, or are you bracing for the next battle?
Well, we went back to Hawaii. First of all, we stopped at Honolulu to drop off the wounded and the dead. We buried a number of them at sea, but they had a number of them they still had to bury. We pulled in there and dropped off the wounded and the dead. Then they took us to the Big Island. They dropped us off, trucked us up to where our camp was going to be, right across where they dropped us off on one side. On the other side was a beautiful army camp. But we couldn't stay there. So we had to sleep out in the ground at nighttime, and we had to build our own quarters. Brought CBs in to build them, and they brought tents in. We built the platforms. But I lucked out on that duty. The CBs came over to get us to help them build the tents. And being 17, not knowing I'm young, the CBs that I went with took me over to their mess hall, and said, now order anything you want, steaks, ice cream, anything you want, which I did. Then we went out to build the tents. We got out there, and they said, now, we want you to sit right here and watch us and tell us about the battle. So that's all I did.
Wow.
So good duty.
Although I'm sure what you had to tell them wasn't a pleasant topic.
No, but they were working, building our tents with their mouths open and listening. They were very good, very nice. Again, they were in their late 30s, you know, they're old people. Yeah, but they took care of me.
And I know we're going to get on to another battle and some more situations that could have and almost did claim your life. But being out there so far from where you grew up, you know, your stepdad's gone and joined the Navy, your mother's died, you're far away from your brother. Did you ever get lonely or feel like, you know, what am I going towards? What's going to happen in my life?
No, I never thought anything about it. Well, I just paid attention to my training. Mm-hmm. And even in civilian life, I used some of the training.
How so?
Well, one of the jobs I had going through life was a lieutenant in the sheriff's office. And I ended up capturing a couple of murderers, which hit all the national TVs and everything.
Where was that?
Sonora, California, Tuolumne County.
So what were the military skills that you used to catch a murderer?
Well, when I kicked the doors in, the first one I didn't kick in. I thought I was some cowboy or something. I just didn't kick. But the second one came right off the hinges, and I had a wrestle with them. And then later on, when I went out on a domestic problem, I walked around the back like that, and the guy was standing there with a deer rifle pointing right at my belly. I just kept on walking, and when I got close enough, I just dove at him, grabbed the rifle, and we wrestled away.
What years would that have been?
60s into 60s, long time ago.
So more than 20 years after your service in the war, but without that Marine Corps training, maybe you had a different result.
Could be. I don't know, but because on the next island, I had a hand-to-hand with a Jap to death.
Well, yeah, and we'll hear about that. So you have this first battle as a 17-year-old. You come back to Hawaii. You've got that R&R.
No R&R.
No R&R? I mean, sitting around telling stories to Seabees as an R&R?
No, that wasn't R. That was work. I was assigned to work.
Sounds like you were jealous of the guys who did have R&R.
Well, to me, R&R was when you went someplace and did something. The only R&R we had, they barbed wire around a beach, and they put Marine guards all around, and they put cases of beer out there, and I didn't drink. I didn't even have one beer, and that was our R&R.
Luxurious.
Yes.
And is that what they came to call Camp Tarawa? Is that the spot on the Big Island?
That's the Big Island. Still is, yeah.
So were you starting to wonder when you're going to get deployed again into action, when the next invasion's going to be?
We knew as soon as we got a full complement of Marines, then we'd be going, and that didn't take long. Yeah.
So where'd they send you?
Well, from Hawaii, we sailed out to the different islands, just going to where we were heading, which was the Mariana Islands, Saipan. 6 months later, we hit the island of Saipan.
And you mentioned how your first invasion, you weren't in the first wave. What about at Saipan?
Second wave, which is the worst wave. Because the first wave, they don't know where you're coming in. The second wave, now they know. They moved all the big guns over to where we were coming in.
And this same role that you have in a machine gun squad?
No, I was number 4 then. But before the battle, I was number 1. You lose them as you go along. Yeah.
So walk me through that. What did you experience as you came ashore on Saipan?
Well, when we first came ashore, we were in a nice area. We were able to see out some field we were going to go through. A nice field, easy, not too high grass, but no trees or anything like that. And our captain was out in front of us, telling us, come, charge, come, calling us. And next thing we knew, he was killed. He was shot dead, you know. Then the first lieutenant took over, and he was smarter. He stayed back further with the group, and he led us until we got up to where we were staying for the night. Then we settled down. The next day, we kept on going. We stayed on the front line for 15 days, I think it was, with not constant fighting, about every other day or something like that. And but we kept losing guys, you know. And finally, we went up to, we were chasing the Japs to the end of the island where Suicide Cliff was. You probably heard of that, where the women threw the babies over the cliff and all that.
They were told this lie, really, this propaganda, what you guys would do to them.
Right, absolutely. And so we were stopped because we didn't want to kill any more. There were women and children up there. And so we were pulled back on the 15th day, I think it was. We were pulled back to Garapan, a little town there. And for really, we were taken off the line. And we bedded down on the beach. And first thing in the morning when we got up, there was a bunch of Army trucks out there, which they weren't ours. And they told us to load up. We're taking us back on the line. They said the Japs broke the last Banzai attack. They broke through the Army, ran over the Army, and we were put in second line as reserves. Don't shoot in front of you because the Army is there. Anyway, I was on guard duty that night from midnight until time to get up, 6 o'clock or something like that. And I'm sitting on my feet in a foxhole, my back against a tree, with my pistol laying on my lap. I had a 45 at that time. My pistol was laying on my lap. Nothing was going on. All of a sudden, I looked. All these guys are coming at me. And I couldn't see them, so I knelt down. I'm looking, and they were close enough. I could see they were Japs. So I started hollering, "They were Japs, Japs." And I start firing. Well, I only had 8 shots. I always put one in the chamber, then I put the clip in, which is 7. And so first thing I start doing is start shooting at them because they were closer than she is. And just shooting at them all around. And I ran out of ammo. And the guy coming at me, he was with a bayonet rifle. He didn't shoot, so I figured after that he was out of ammunition too. So I jumped up when he was coming at me with that bayonet. I just threw my pistol at him, and it hit him someplace. Then I jumped up and grabbed the rifle, just like I did later, years later.
Yeah.
I grabbed the rifle, and so we wrestled. Now, one of the guys in the foxhole put his carbine up underneath the Japs' area here, and just unloaded the rifle, the carbine. And the others, what was left, retreated. But we were on the top of a hill like that. And when I was fighting with that guy, he was on right on the crest. They start going down. Well, then all the ones that were left, couldn't see them. So I got back down the foxhole. And I didn't have my machine gun at the time. I'd lost it in a fight earlier. Anyway, I walked over to their 2 first lieutenants. One was an acting captain, the other was his executive officer. And I told him if I had my machine gun, I could have got most of them. Now I'm 18 years old. I think I know what I'm doing. And anyway, just then, I heard a guy hollering, "Help, help, help." So I just jumped up, and I didn't know why, but I ran out there to help him. The guy was holding this guy that fell back in his arm when he got shot. He was already dead, and the other guy was standing holding him. Well, I ran around to pick up his feet, and he got shot. And he went down, so I went down too. And I crawled around to him to see if I could help him. As I said, the other guy was dead. So I just started dragging him, and I didn't get shot. I got a hand grenade in my leg, shrapnel in my leg. Yeah. That ended me. That was the end of my war experience right there.
So I'm guessing that I know you're a recipient of the Purple Heart and the Silver Star.
Yeah.
Those both come in that one action right there that you're talking about?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I got the hand grenade.
Yeah.
So that was the Purple Heart.
And you were risking your own life to try to save another, thus the Silver Star.
That's what it amounts to.
Yeah. Let's fill in some blanks, though. Right before that, you're saying if I had my machine gun, I could have taken them out. So that situation where you're on guard duty and your pistol's on your lap and you see all these Japanese running towards you in the dark.
Yeah.
How badly were you guys outnumbered there?
Well, at that particular time, I have no idea, but all I know, there was a lot of them coming.
And you unload every round that you have. And then it's
8. Yeah. I did have time to reload.
And then it's hand-to-hand combat. I mean, it's you or him.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what happened there, yeah.
Had you ever, I'm sure you trained for that a little bit, but.
No. Oh, yeah, we had bayonet training and all that kind of stuff.
Does your adrenaline start pumping a little bit?
That's why I think I went out there. I was already, I had that going and I didn't know it. After thinking about it often, why did I do such a stupid thing? Because I could see the Japs out there, all of them shooting at us. Mm-hmm. And I ran right into it. We were told not to do that.
But it sounds like you didn't hesitate.
Well, evidently not, no.
And you weren't scared during any of this?
I don't remember being scared. I was too busy doing something.
So you go to help this guy. The other guy that he was trying to help is dead.
Yeah.
Then he's wounded. And as you're trying to drag him away, what happened? You hear a noise? You feel something? What stopped you?
Well, I felt that piece of metal go into my leg, you know. And when I looked down, you can blood was, your body has a lot of pressure, blood pressure. And it was shooting like crazy. I mean, up high, out of the leg, you know.
So you feel something hit your leg, you look down, and blood is squirting out of there like being shot from a gun.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you starting to get scared yet then?
No, no. I don't remember ever getting scared.
Wow.
Ever. That doesn't mean that I was brave or anything like that. It was just, I think I was out of my mind, to tell you the truth.
The adrenaline and the intensity of the situation had taken over?
Yeah. And if I had my machine gun, and you talk about on guard duty, my machine gun would have been in the foxhole where these other two guys were, because we have three in there.
Did I ask you how you lost it?
It was during another fight. Bullet took it out.
So it wasn't functional anymore?
No.
It wasn't like you misplaced it. They knocked it out.
I didn't misplace it, no. I could use it, so they just kept it back in where we were R&R, supposedly. Supposedly 1 hour or one night. Yeah.
I guess that's a question, too, and not to bounce around here, but you said 15 days of combat there on Saipan.
Yeah.
Did you guys have enough to eat, to drink?
Yeah. Had all the food we wanted. Always sea rations, little cans like that. Uh-huh. Tastes terrible.
You guys were aware of what was happening with that suicide cliff and what the Japanese were telling them?
I didn't have any idea about that. All I knew is that we were stopped because there was women and kids up there.
You learned more about that later, I guess.
Yeah.
So the hand grenade hits, goes into your leg, you're squirting blood everywhere.
I dragged that guy back to a foxhole, first one I ran into, put him in there, and the corpsman came over to start taking care of him because they could see me, but they couldn't see him. They were still shooting at me. So I crawled looking for another hole going over that road, over the hill, trying to get away from their sight.
You had to be losing a lot of blood.
Well, yeah, but the corpsman came back to me, and he used my medical pack, put it on there, and then wrapped it around the leg to stop the bleeding. But it didn't stop it because pressure was so high that the blood was washing away the medicine that he put on there, and it went right through the padding that he put on there. It went right through it, and still squirting up. Yeah.
And you were still conscious?
Yeah, I was conscious all the time.
Were you in pain?
If I was, I didn't know it. I really don't remember any pain.
So what did they finally have to do to stop the bleeding and save your life?
Well, put a new Band-Aid on until it finally stopped, yeah.
Well, that's a relief, and I hope none of you listening right now got too squeamish with that description. We'll give you a moment to catch your breath. You'll find a short video of Bob Andre at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and you'll hear what the government thought of his heroics on Saipan. When Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old Bob Andre of Las Vegas, Nevada. Originally from Richmond, California, in July 1944, he was an 18-year-old Marine on Saipan, where a three-week-long battle claimed the lives of nearly 3,500 Americans. There were more than 10,000 wounded, including Bob, who just finished describing that moment when, while rendering aid to a wounded Marine, he was struck in the leg with shrapnel from a hand grenade. I know you've told this story before, and you tell it like it's no big deal.
Well, I can't help it. That's the way it was to me at the time. Yeah.
But I hope you understand that for the rest of us, we're saying, how in the world did that guy do that?
Like I said a moment ago, it's either out of my head or something.
And when did it start to sink in, the condition that you were in? And how would you describe that condition?
I don't remember what I did, to tell you the truth. All I know is that I was out of the war. The Jeep came up there, and they loaded me on a Jeep with a couple other wounded guys, and they had a second lieutenant ride as guard on the Jeep and took it down to the field hospital. Then they looked at me, the doctor did. They triaged me there, and they said, send him out to the hospital ship. They couldn't operate on me there. So they sent me out the hospital ship, and I stayed there about 3 or 4 or 5 days, I guess, before they finally got around to operating on me.
And what did they have to do to fix you up?
Oh, it cut a big hole in my leg. It was about this big.
So you're about, 6 inches in diameter?
Yeah, big. It went down like a V, and the metal had hit the bone, the main bone. That's where he found it. And so when I was in New Caledonia at the hospital, they'd come in every day and change the bandage and put Vaseline gauze in there. They'd go down to the bone and they'd start wrapping it around because all the skin from here down to the bone was chewed up by that shrapnel.
Wow. So this took a lot of your flesh,
but
did not damage your bone structure.
No, it didn't hurt. Had it done it, I would have been in a damn cast up to the whole body, you know.
Was there some pain at some point?
If there was, I don't remember. I really mean it. I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
I just don't remember. I didn't dwell on it anyway. Kind of like now.
But as you're sitting there on the hospital ship or the field hospital or later on, you probably had a lot of time to think about a lot of things. What kind of stuff went through your mind?
Girls.
They're nice to the guy in the hospital bed?
The nurses weren't nice to privates. They were always with the officers. They could talk to us. I'm joking. You know that. Okay. No, they treated me great. Most of them were men aboard the hospital ship. And the hospital, field hospital in New Caledonia, they were all RNs. But they had so many wounded that they didn't pay much attention to us. As far as the Silver Star, I met another one of the guys who was in my outfit, and he had told me that they put me in for the Silver Star, but they put a lot of people in for medals. In Washington, they're the ones who decide. In the Marine Corps, officers don't decide. And it has to be verified by an officer. It happened to be, there were two officers I was talking to when I went out there. And he told me about it. I forgot all about it. After a while, many months, I was finally discharged from the Marines, went home. I was home maybe 8 months or so, and I got a call that they're awarding me the Silver Star, and they want to put a parade on in Treasure Island, San Francisco Bay, and award me the Silver Star. I sent them a letter back and told them, just send me the star. I can't take time off from work. So I got it through the mail. I didn't get the parade.
Sounds like you weren't looking for the attention.
I guess so. I've told you more than I should, I guess.
No, you didn't. And I've talked to so many guys, and my grandfather received a Silver Star for pulling 26 guys out of burning tanks in Europe.
Did he really?
And he didn't talk about it either. And one of his reasons was he knew how many guys didn't come home. Was there a point in all of that for you where it sank in how many of your friends didn't get to come home?
No, I did what I was told to do. And when I got out, I just worried about making a living, trying to make money, you know, no education.
How about the extent of your injury? Is that something that bothered you at all after the war?
Well, it did for a couple of years, you know, but because there was a lot of mass that had to fill up that hole. You know, it took quite a while to do that with tissue and stuff, yeah.
So were you weaker on that side, or you just deal with
just
pain?
Just the leg, yeah. But when I went to work for the telephone company, that was good because I was climbing telephone poles and stuff like that, was strengthening the leg up.
Are there any other close calls you didn't tell us about that you think back on and you say, yeah, that was almost my number two?
Sure, all there was. I thought I was shot. We were had to go from one side of the airstrip to the other side and hit me in the back, spun me around, and I felt down there. It was all wet. I thought I was shot. It's not my canteen is all. So the guys teased me about that, yeah.
Well-placed canteen, though.
Yeah, right. Right in the butt.
Well, I'm glad you can laugh about it now, because for so many, it would not be a laughing matter. And it was so gruesome there. And you've given us a little taste of that. and I know you had an experience just last year that probably brought some of these things back to mind for you when you went to Washington, D.C.,
yeah.
Honor Flight Southern Nevada.
Yeah.
What did you get out of that?
Well, I never ever thought about going to New York or Washington or any of those places because I'm a Westerner. But it was quite a thrill to do that, to see what other people have done to show us off, treat us.
And what did you think about when you were at that World War II memorial where they've got those 4,000 gold stars representing over 400,000 Americans who died? What went through your mind while you took that in?
That was a lot in a short time to take in.
Well, and you almost left us as an 18-year-old Marine in the Pacific. And a lot of teenage Marines did die on those two islands, and older Marines too.
Yeah.
How should those guys be remembered today?
Well, you know, it's been, what, 70, 80 years ago now? They're being remembered only by the immediate families, I think, not by new kids. They have no idea what took place. Matter of fact, we just had Veterans Day in this facility, and most of the guys in here are all pilots and officers, and they all got up and gave a nice speech, which is nice. That's good. They were pilots, but not one was in combat. I was the last one to talk, and I didn't say near what I should have said, I guess, because they want to know about being in the service. Well, what they were talking about, all of them, were glory boys, and they didn't give a true picture.
Their experience wasn't the same as yours?
No.
Most of us don't have any idea of the price you really paid out there. And I've talked to a lot of guys. There are guys that have physical wounds that bother them forever, guys that lose limbs, guys that have debilitating injuries. And what we haven't talked a lot about over the years, but now more and more, the mental and emotional wounds or scars that stick with you.
Yeah.
Have you had to deal with some of those? And if so, how have you endured or overcome some of that?
When I first came back, I did. I used to sleep with a knife underneath my pillow and everything else. Mm. But that was 70 years ago or whatever. So I really don't think it. I have other things to entertain me now.
Well, and I hear you talking about being in combat. And that's different than a lot of the experiences of other veterans who risked their lives in their own way but didn't go through what you went through. So for those of us who haven't experienced that, who haven't had our lives in that perilous position, what do you think are the important things we need to understand about what that's like and what you really did out there?
Well, everybody has a different take on it. With me, being all by myself, I really didn't have much to think about anything, really. I didn't. Pretty stupid for an old man, I guess, but that's the way I'm in. A lot of things I didn't talk about. Not because I don't talk about myself much.
What you're telling me is there are a lot of other things you did that most of us have never done, but you're gun shy about talking about it because you don't want people to think you're bragging.
Bingo. That's right. Hard for me to say that even.
But you had to fight with your hands, use your machine gun. Use your pistol, your carbine, whatever methods to stay alive, and the enemy was after you.
Yeah, you pretty well covered it, yeah.
Is there one thing that you saw or experienced that kind of was the most difficult thing or something that if you said, your 18-year-old's out there, I hope he never deals with this?
Funny part about it, when I never ever thought myself being real young until I got out into the real life as a civilian, and then I see these kids and I think, my God, that young, I can't really believe I did some of the things I did, but I did.
Well, and how about this question? I realize there's probably more that you didn't tell me than you did tell me, and the stuff you did tell me is eye-opening for the rest of us who haven't done stuff like that. Do you ever look back at some of those situations or moments and say, how did I survive? Was somebody else pulling a string for me? How did I get out of that scenario?
I know where you're coming from. No, I didn't. I'm a non-religious person. I believe in myself. That I can do whatever I have to do, and because I experienced that in other than war many ways, and I still believe that, even though I'm 90, I'm over 90.
I didn't ask you, Bob, do you have kids and grandkids?
I have one son. I found out what caused it. I only had one. He has two girls, and one's married, yeah.
I don't mean to sound melodramatic or put thoughts in your head, but have you ever thought, hey, if that hand grenade was a little off or if that bullet or that situation went a little differently, my son and his kids wouldn't be here?
No, I really haven't.
It's true, though, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But anyway, as far as what I did over there, the kids don't think anything of it. To them, it's passé. You know,
really?
Because they were raised with it. You look around, you see any war stuff in here? Other than that, American flag, Marine flag. Now, you see anything else in here?
No, and I've been in a lot of Marines' homes. And a lot of times there's a doormat.
Yeah.
Or there's a flag, or there's the globe and anchor. I mean, it's hard to miss the once a Marine, always a Marine thing.
Yeah, but I don't put anything out.
And why don't you?
Just don't feel like, again, showing off or something. Because I know it's quite an honor to get that award, because I know I can pull it up on our iPhones. Uh-huh. You've done that yet?
Your citation?
Yeah.
Maybe I should, so I can read it for our listeners.
Well, you could read that, yeah.
I want to see this right now. I want to watch a 92-year-old Marine Corps Silver Star recipient pull up the citation on his smartphone. I've never done that before.
Robert Warren Andre.
Well, there you go. So this, the President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Silver Star to Private First Class Robert W. Andre, United States Marine Corps Reserve, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity while serving with Company C, 1st Battalion, 6th Marines, 2nd Marine Division, in action against enemy Japanese forces on Saipan, Marianas Islands, 8 July 1944. When his platoon was momentarily held up during a firefight, Private First Class Andre observed a wounded man in front of the lines. Despite accurate enemy fire, he went to the aid of his comrade, and, although wounded himself, succeeded in returning the wounded man to our lines. His courage and devotion to duty were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. They thought that was a big deal, Bob.
Yeah, I guess they did. I'm glad to get back in one piece.
Is it different to hear those words about you, or have you seen them so many times it doesn't faze you?
Well, I think you described it there. It really, I read it, but I can't believe I did that.
Yeah, that's, I guess, when you think back on it now, I know you were just 18, but do you think you would do that again if given the chance?
No, being realistic, I don't think so.
You think that guy was kind of foolish or risking his life too much?
The guy that did that?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, but I'm glad I did it.
And I'm sure the guy whose life you saved was glad you did it.
I hope so, yeah.
You ever wonder what happened to him?
I have occasionally, but not lately. I figure if he's not passed on, he's pretty close to it.
Did you ever find out his name?
No, I really didn't. Neither one of them. Huh. But they were Mexicans, I know.
And one of them died.
He was dead when I got there.
But the other one survived, and who knows? He could still be out there.
I presume he survived. I have no idea. When they took me away, I don't know where he was, whether they were able to take care of him in triage or whether he had to go aboard hospital ship.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of things I didn't ask you about, and I don't want to keep you forever. But I do want to make sure that I say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, for risking your life for us, and for telling us about it, because it's important that we know these things. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you think it's important for us to know about you and all those other Marines out there in the Pacific?
I really can't think of anything. I know my younger brother, who's passed away now, wanted me to be buried in Arlington. So I got all the literature to do that. But now that he's passed on, I don't think I'm going to do that. I'll just be buried here locally.
Well, I'll tell you, the Veterans Cemetery in Las Vegas, out toward Boulder City,
yeah,
that is a very beautiful spot.
Yeah, that's where I have a plot there already.
And what about, since we weren't alive, since most of us didn't live through World War II, what's the most important thing we need to know about what you guys did and why you had to do it?
That is hard for me to answer. I did it only because, like I said, I really liked the idea of, I saw that movie, yeah, Wake Island, and I thought, well, they could use some help. And they made the Japs a real mean bunch of people. Believe me, they're not that mean. They were doing what they were told.
With time comes perspective, and Bob Andre has had more than 70 years to process those extreme situations he encountered as a teenage Marine in World War II. We're out of time on today's program, but a big thanks to Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for introducing me to Bob. Check out those photos and a brief video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.